It's Berlin briefing time, and we have to talk about that phone call by Donald Trump and Russia's Vladimir Putin and how it ended Friedrich Merz's attempt to debut as a peacemaker in Europe after that visit in Kiev by the European leaders who tried and bring about an unconditional 30-day ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia. Well, that didn't happen. What does it mean for the German leadership by the newly elected chancellor here in Germany? After all, he promised to his allies he would lead. Can Europe recover from this, or will they simply because they have to? And what new reality do we find ourselves in after the US president effectively turned his back on Europe and Ukraine and sided with Putin? Or did he? In 20 minutes or so, you will be fully briefed on where this is leaving Ukraine, Europe, and your own security wherever you leave, because yes, it's hard to avoid the impact of this historic week. With me here to dissect what happened and look at what comes next is by far one of the best informed journalists here in Berlin, Reuters chief reporter Andreas Rinke, and Dr. Eileen Matley, who's a senior research fellow at the Center for Security and Defense here in Berlin. And Andreas, I want to start with you. What exactly went wrong for the Europeans, for Ukraine? What did we just see unfold in that phone call?
Well, I think the disappointment which we saw beginning from Monday evening was that Trump, with whom the Europeans had talked several times in the days before, didn't stick to the promises he made in the phone calls with Merz, Macron, Starmer, and some others, because the Europeans were pretty sure that Trump understood and accepted that you have a two-way approach. One is to demand unconditional ceasefire, and the second is, if Putin doesn't go this way, go for sanctions. And Trump didn't want to hear anything about sanctions anymore after the phone call with Putin, praised Russia as an important trading partner, and told the Ukraine president simply that he has to talk to Russia. I mean, that's it. And that was, of course, not what the Europeans expected.
It wasn't. And we want to actually take a look at a tweet that Friedrich Merz, the German chancellor, sent just hours before Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump spoke. Donald Trump had coordinated with his European partners beforehand. And this is what it says. Putin must agree to a ceasefire and peace talks. I spoke with POTUS, the president, and the upcoming phone call between President Trump and Putin. We want to continue this exchange today. He must have felt incredibly certain to post this on X.
Well, he must have been incredibly hopeful, I would say. I mean, they don't have illusions. Trump is Trump. And they weren't 100% sure that Trump would follow what he had talked about with the Europeans. So there was this risk. They knew about this risk. But I think they were still disappointed about the outcome because they expected at least a little bit more from Trump making pressure on Putin, which he obviously didn't do.
So then we have the outcome that instead of an unconditional ceasefire for 30 days, there's now an agreement to launch talks towards a ceasefire. So no talk of any kind of peace anytime soon. Now we're getting into the details. Will it take place in the Vatican? So this is actually shifting the timeline. Then after the debriefing phone call, which the US president did do with his European allies, this is what Friedrich Merz posted then in German. Essentially, he was putting a bit of a gloss on the outcome. Let's look at that second tweet. Europe and the United States are very united. We will accompany Ukraine on the way to a ceasefire very closely. This is something different.
This is different. I think it shows the necessary exercise now, which is support Ukraine, stay together in Europe, try to keep Trump on board, which is the main goal at the moment. I mean, it doesn't sound very ambitious, but actually it is ambitious, simply to keep him on board, because that would mean that Ukraine still gets intelligence information, which wasn't sure if the Americans simply drop out of this war, which was something which Vance actually did say before the phone call with Putin, that they are going to be fed up and there's a possibility or the danger from the European and the Ukrainian side that they will simply leave the war and leave Ukraine to defend itself without the US.
So I want to take this to you, Eileen Matley. What does this tell us, or do you actually see as a scholar who you've studied defense policy of previous administrations in the United States? Is there any kind of logic that you can track in this?
I think it is very difficult to disseminate any or delineate any sort of logic and or strategy behind what Trump in particular is doing. I would like to counter a bit what has just been said between the two of you. Yes, it was certainly not what Ukraine and or European leaders had hoped for going into the phone call on Monday. Yet at the same time, I wouldn't come to the conclusion just now that we are seeing the end of US support towards Ukraine, given the very erratic behavior that Trump is quite famous for. And to be fair, in the past couple of months, ever since he took office on the 20th of January this year, he has been oscillating between supporting Ukraine, between siding Putin, and admittedly he's been seen or regarded and perceived as siding more with Putin than with Ukraine. But at the same time, you've also already alluded to the phone call that took place between Trump and the European leaders, in which he apparently sided with Ukraine as well as Europeans. So I'm not quite sure what to make of all this yet, but I wouldn't arrive at the conclusion just yet that we are seeing the end of the US trying to help bring an end to this war.
Well, in fact, we actually are seeing the Senate leaders organizing potential next US sanctions. Donald Trump himself is not willing to go down that road, which the Europeans took directly after what essentially was an embarrassment, Andreas, wasn't it? We saw the newly elected chancellor travel to Kiev together with Emmanuel Macron, Donald Tusk of Poland, and also Keir Starmer of Britain. Britain, of course, having left the European Union, but now we have this new alliance of the willing, them demonstrating their fully fledged support for Ukraine, bringing Donald Trump on board in a much publicized first phone call with all them together and launching this initiative and actually setting a deadline for an unconditional 30-day ceasefire. This is, as we're recording this 10 days ago, that feels like very distant history now. It completely didn't work out.
I wouldn't go that far. At first, I just said that Trump is still on board. So that's an achievement, I would call that. Second is the Europeans have said in Kiev, either you have the ceasefire or we are working on new sanctions. And to be fair, they started talking about new sanctions, not the 17th package of the EU, but the 18th package, which is supposed to be harsher than the 17th one. They started on Monday working on that. So it depends very much how far the Europeans go down this way. If they really follow and decide on an 18th sanctions package, I think for their credibility, there's no problem. There's still a problem for Ukraine, because if you don't have US sanctions at the same time, of course, the pressure which you can put on Russia and Putin is much less than if the Europeans do it alone. So there's disappointment from this point of view, because obviously, following diplomats, what they said about the phone call, Trump threatened a veto if the US Congress goes down the sanction way. So it's too early to decide if it's really an embarrassment for the Europeans. It's not good for Ukraine. That's what we know for now. And I wouldn't put too much hope into these peace talks or preliminary peace talks in the Vatican. I think it's meant to cool down the whole situation now and try to keep this weakened axis US-Europe.
Yeah, that's the impression of many people I've spoken to, that this is essentially just kicking the can down the road and drawing out the process and essentially drawing out the war. Now, European defense and foreign ministers were meeting just after all of this unfolded. And on Tuesday, the day after the phone call, they implemented the 17th package of sanctions, which is mainly going after the Russian shadow fleet, as it's called, which is still shipping oil and gas, bringing much needed cash also to the war effort. So the Europeans are getting tougher on that. We have a clip of Johann Wadephul, the new German foreign minister, speaking exactly also about the option of a next package of sanctions. And this is speaking at the moment where the ink wasn't quite dry on that 17th package that's just been passed.
We've repeatedly made it clear that we now expect one thing from Russia, quite simply, namely a ceasefire, unconditionally and immediately. We realize with disillusionment that Russia has not yet taken this decisive step, and we will have to respond to this. As long as President Putin does not react and is not prepared to negotiate seriously, there will be a great willingness in Europe to put together further sanctions packages and also to take further measures that restrict his economic and political room for maneuver.
So, Eileen Matley, how much decisiveness do you read into those comments, and what do you believe will it take for Friedrich Merz, who promised a lot more leadership, who had this very big stage in Kiev, but also in European capitals, in Paris and in Warsaw, to lay out that he is willing to unite Europeans behind that effort to end this war with a just peace effort? What will it take for him to do that?
Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European current affairs programme Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans Wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge, bringing you a combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Join us every Thursday.
Well, I think it would take to most certainly keep the U.S. not only on board, but convince the U.S., in particular President Trump, to pressure Putin much more than he has in the past. At the same time, I'm convinced that the new German government is committed to achieving exactly that, bringing about a just peace for Ukraine. I'm not quite certain that only the sanction packages that we've now just talked about will do the trick. I think what's also very necessary is to think about, not only think about, but also to deliver more and possibly new weapon systems to the battlefield. Now, we've seen, I believe it was last week, or heard last week, that the new government is now unwilling to talk about what exactly they want to deliver to Ukraine, referring to what's sort of in the scholarly world referred to as strategic ambiguity, which I find a bit interesting and peculiar, given that when he was still in the opposition, Friedrich Merz, he was calling very robustly, for example, for sending the Taurus missile to Ukraine. And now being asked and pressed for exactly that, and asked whether this new government would be willing to do exactly that, he is shying away from answering the question. Now, there is some sense and some prudence in not talking about where the red lines are in order to sort of to blur the picture for the Kremlin. I completely see that. On the one hand, at the same time, the new government could also use that as an excuse, because we just don't know what exactly they are delivering or not. But what is clear and what is certain, Ukraine also not only needs the sort of the economic pressure to be put on Russia, but also more and possibly new military systems, weapon systems, as well as, and that's what my colleague has earlier referred to, intelligence sharing, which is absolutely vital and which only the US at this point in time can deliver, because otherwise the Ukraine just doesn't know where to shoot. So that in combination is needed and necessary. And I think that the jury is still out on whether Merz and his government will be able to unite Europeans. So far, I think he has a good track record to show for, because first days in office, he has traveled to Paris, to Warsaw, to Ukraine, and really demonstrated that he is behind the proclaimed goal of wanting to not only support Ukraine, but really bringing an end to this war for Ukrainians. At the same time, I would not put all my eggs in the German basket, so to speak. I think it will take more than just Friedrich Merz. It will take the other European, the sort of big European leaders, namely Starmer, Macron, Tusk, possibly also the Italians, to really to bring about something meaningful for the support of Ukraine.
Yeah, Andreas, it was remarkable how both Emmanuel Macron, but even more remarkable that Donald Tusk was rolling out the red carpet. We were on that, both on that first trip, on his very first full day in office. And Donald Tusk, against the backdrop of a presidential election where he needed to be seen to be tough on Germany to not alienate voters. So that was a political risk Donald Tusk, too, was willing to take. So there is a will to see him succeed. But what grade would you give him so far?
I'm not a teacher, I don't give grades, but I agree completely with the analysis that for the first 2 weeks of his chancellorship, Merz acted correctly and wisely on the European scale. Of course, he's not the only one. Leading in Europe doesn't mean there's one leader. It means that you organize leadership. And that's exactly what he was doing with the trip to Kiev. And he was, together with Macron, the only one who was present in all the phone talks with Trump. So he has reached within 2 weeks the center of these attempts to convince Trump. And he will be at the center of organizing sanctions now. Of course, that only works together with some countries which have been mentioned now. Some haven't, like Hungary, for example. So he has met already with Orban. He has met with Meloni. And I think he knows exactly that he needs the 27 governments. But so far, he's willing to do it. I don't know if the German public already understand what that means, because it means probably that we have to spend much more on Ukraine. We have to be sure that we can do it without the US, which sounds unrealistic at the moment, but there are preparations going on that we at least give some of the intelligence information which the US are giving. I mean, that's mainly the task of France and Britain. And this new German government has stepped up its defense spending for Ukraine this year up to 7 billion. Already, and my guess is that at the end of the year it will be much more. And not only that, we have to support Ukraine financially as well.
Yeah, ultimately, I mean, we saw Johann Wadephul already state that Germany would also be in favor of even a 5% GDP goal for defense spending. Currently, it's just made above 2%. The NATO aim is set to be 3.5%. So Germany is willing to be in line verbally for now. Friedrich Merz has the money in the sense that there's no longer a debt break. So if he gets the political majority, he will be able to implement that. What is your assessment, what it will take for Friedrich Merz to also get Germany, the German public, behind him on this?
That is a very tricky and difficult to answer question in my mind. But so first off, yes, the new foreign minister, Wadephul, has backed the goal of spending 5%. And it is not unlikely that this will end up to be the official new defense pledge that will be agreed upon in late June in The Hague by all the NATO leaders. At the same time, and that worries me a bit, Friedrich Merz, so far at least, seems to be disagreeing or seems to be reluctant to back this goal as well. He's sort of claimed that it isn't really about numbers, but capabilities. Yes, of course, that is true. At the same time, you need the numbers in order to generate capabilities. And it's more or less common sense by now among experts that it will take at least 3.5 or possibly even 4% to make good on the promises that Germany has made towards NATO. Friedrich Merz himself just recently in his first government declaration claimed to put the Bundeswehr, the German armed forces, into a position to become the conventionally strongest army in Europe. Now, that is a goal that, if you all remember, that Scholz has also proclaimed during his chancellorship, I believe it was in May 2022, and he didn't deliver on that. So I think that the circumstances speak in favor of Friedrich Merz, because he has the money, as you just said, or has the potential money to deliver on that promise. At the same time, I think he's shying away from officially backing this goal for the time being, because we are talking about really vast numbers, even if we're only talking about the 3.5% spending being spent on hard security or hard military power, and then the other 1.5% supposed to be spent on softer targets like military infrastructure and the like. But still, we are talking about 150, 160 billion euros that would go to the defense budget alone. I think there are reasonable and prudent arguments to be made to point to, namely, the support of Ukraine and also the danger that Putin's Russia is presenting not only for Ukraine, but also for NATO and not only the Baltic states. And I think that is sort of rhetorically a bit of a mistake and misleading to always point to the Baltics that could be next. We're talking about NATO being next because the Baltics are a part of NATO and German soldiers are stationed in Lithuania and have been stationed there since 2017. And if push came to shove, those very German soldiers would be in the front line defending not only Lithuania, but NATO and thereby Germany as well.
That's also why Friedrich Merz is visiting that brigade in Lithuania. You mentioned his first big speech in Parliament. We have a clip from that, and I'll bring you in on that, Andreas. Let's just take a listen.
The outcome of this war will decide whether there will be the rule of law in Europe and the world or tyranny.
So he's clearly put this at the centre of what this new government is going to be about.
Yeah, that's why I wouldn't agree with the assessment of what Merz is really going to do or willing to do. I think he's pretty decisive. When he was talking about capabilities rather than percentages in the NATO discussion, it was rather a tactical move. I think he is willing as well to go up to 3.5%. I think it's better to discuss 3.5% instead of 5, because that's creating a lot of confusions. He's willing to do that, but he knows that a lot of EU partners can't do it. We have a reformed debt brake. Other more indebted EU countries don't have this possibility. So he knows that there's tension between the European NATO partners, how to increase and in which steps they are able to increase. I think Germany can do it now, but it takes a few years to step up a German army. So I would also defend Olaf Scholz on that. The aim was clear, but you don't create the strongest army in Europe within 3 years. We are lacking personnel, we are lacking material, we were lacking money, so that's possible. I think we need a bit more patience, even though the Russian threat is there. But as you mentioned, he's going to Lithuania also within the first 2 weeks of his chancellorship to visit this brigade. And I think that's a visible sign that the Germans stick to their commitments and that we are willing to defend whichever NATO country is attacked or might be attacked.
And I just want to map out the clear differences between him and Olaf Scholz. Friedrich Merz claims that he will now deliver the real Zeitenwende, this real turnaround in policy, which Olaf Scholz had declared. He Olaf Scholz made it his hallmark policy to say that he will not deliver this Taurus long-range weapons system. He said it's something he would not be willing to do. As opposition leader Friedrich Merz said, it should be delivered right now without any strings attached. He's kind of walked that back quite a bit, to the point where now that he's in government, he doesn't want to have any kind of public debate about it anymore, and claims that he was pushed to having this debate in the first place. But there's also one more notable difference, and we have a clip of him in a minute. Olaf Scholz said that by no means can Germany get involved in this war. So does Friedrich Merz, but he formulates it very differently. Let's just take a listen to that.
Wir sind nicht Kriegspartei.
We are not party to this war, and we do not want to become that. But neither are we unaffected bystanders or intermediaries.
Andreas, what do you make of that positioning?
We as journalists always look for the differences between a new and an old chancellor, but I would say that in Ukraine policy, it's rather continuity between Olaf Scholz and Friedrich Merz. Friedrich Merz has more or less the same position now on Taurus. He has the same position on stepping up defense expenditure on Ukraine. And I would say he shares the same skeptical approach about sending soldiers from NATO countries to Ukraine after the end of the war. He was skeptical already as an opposition leader on that. And he's skeptical now. He thinks it's a debate which France and Britain have started. I think that France has started because it's also taking away the look on how much they actually deliver as weapons to Ukraine, which is not much in comparison to other European countries like Britain or Germany. So it's seen as a rather artificial debate. And he has the same approach that the best way to defend Ukraine after the war is to step up financing and supporting Ukrainian army and to keep it and make it strong.
And I just wanted to check in with you on what do you believe just happened this week? Has this whole conflict now been drawn out? Has Europe just become a more dangerous place? Has it become more stable? Because Donald Trump clearly also wants to do potentially business with Russia again. Where are we?
I sort of coming back to what you asked in the beginning, whether I can delineate a sort of strategy behind what Trump is doing. I still stick to my answer from the beginning that I can't really see a strategy. But what we can certainly see in my mind is that he has a goal, a clear goal that he wants to pursue, and that is to end the war at whichever cost and whatever it will take. And obviously that is to the clear disadvantage of Ukraine and also by extension of Europeans. I wouldn't necessarily draw the conclusion from that that we are now at the end of the possibility of coming together with the US and trying to sort of nudge the US into the right direction. And by that I mean to sort of get their weight behind Ukraine and thereby also us Europeans again. But certainly it's sort of the expectations were different, as we've discussed in the beginning. But again, I would really emphasize that I don't see necessarily the end of the, at least the possibility of brokering a sort of transatlantic consensus around Ukraine and thereby also European security.
Andreas, what will it take for the E4? So that includes Britain, Poland, France, and now the newly elected German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, to recover from what was a setback. They did take a political risk here. It did not work out as planned. So what will it take, and what will be the opportunity? Will this come in the shape and form of this 18th package? What will that have to feel like, this new package of sanctions that will now be debated?
Well, always like in politics, it has events have two sides. One negative side, which you just stressed, and one positive side is that these EU countries and Britain are much more united than they were 2 weeks before. It was another wake-up call for the Europeans that they might have to do it alone. And that was a harsh reminder, this phone call by Trump and Putin, that they should speed up their preparations of supporting Ukraine, supporting themselves in defensiveness against Russia. And I think looking from this angle, it has a positive aspect, actually, because it's not only Britain, France, Germany, Poland. Italy has been included. The Finnish prime minister, or president, sorry, was on the phone call, the last one as well. And even Ursula von der Leyen, as the EU Commission leader, was selected by Trump, interestingly enough, to be on the phone call. So obviously Trump sees Europe as more united as 2 weeks ago. And that's maybe a positive side, and I would agree completely. When Trump looks on Ukraine, he has only one interest, that's ending this war. He's not really interested in Ukraine. That's the danger. But if he sees that the Europeans are united and they actually step up their efforts, he might be willing that at least some sort of support from the US is still coming.
I just want to take us back one more step at the end to essentially what was the declaration of what Friedrich Merz's and the E4's aim is as they went for that historic trip to Kiev on the 10th of May. This is how Friedrich Merz expressed his resolve. And what I would like to ask you both as a concluding question is what that means for you, what his next step will have to be if this is the road he wants to take. Let's take a listen.
The signal.
We are signaling that we are prepared to do anything to end this war as fast as possible. We are prepared to contribute anything that we can and must.
Vier Partner der Ukraine leisten können und leisten müssen.
Eileen Matley, what does that mean in terms of what would have to be on the top to-do list for Friedrich Merz now after these events that we saw?
I think what he will need to do and what his government will continue to do is reach out to the Americans, reach out to the US administration, possibly also behind the scenes and not go about that publicly, to, you know, continue reiterating how important it is that Russia must not win this war. At the same time, preparing for the option that he will not be heard, that those arguments will just not resonate with the current US administration, or at least parts of it, especially Donald Trump. And in that case, it is all the more important that Friedrich Merz, together with his European partners, whether it's in the Weimar Plus format, in the E3 format, all the sort of other big European leaders must be included. And with those leaders, he must coordinate the questions of sending more weapons in order to bring Ukraine into a more powerful position on the battlefield.
Andreas, what do you expect will have to be his next step?
Keep Europe together. So we'll see still a very intensive diplomacy going on between the capitals and with Brussels. That's the most important step, reaching out to other countries which support Russia in one way or another. Yesterday he had a phone call with Indian Modi. That is, I think, very important. The 18th sanction package has to come quickly, much more quickly than sanction packages before, and it has to be painful for Russia. And on the American side, yes, you have to keep contacts. The Europeans yesterday, also on the initiative of Merz, proposed a so-called technical meeting to prepare talks with Russia in the Vatican. I think that's important to give Trump the impression that, yes, we take you seriously. Yes, we see your concerns. But at the same time, this way we are going shows you, or should show you, that Putin doesn't want a peace. And I think that's mixture of things he has to do will hopefully lead to some progress. And of course, supporting Ukraine, as it was just mentioned, is very important, because we forget that just half a year ago, it was our attempt and strategy to say we have to make Ukraine on the battlefield so strong that it has negotiation power against Russia. Since Trump is in power, the strategy aims have changed completely.
And of course, we expect Friedrich Merz, he said he would visit Donald Trump very soon. We don't know what that means exactly, but it sounds more like within a matter of weeks rather than months. So the whole world will be, of course, watching whether he's able to establish some kind of rapport, as did actually Emmanuel Macron and Keir Starmer in the past. But we saw that that doesn't mean that all sides are aligned, even when they've had a joint phone call. With that, we'll leave it. I'm sure this is not the last time we'll be speaking about this. Eileen Matley, thank you very much for joining us here today. Also, Andreas Rinke, thank you very much for your time and your analysis, as always. So, Friedrich Merz and the E4 European leaders clearly have their work cut out for them, both in relation to Donald Trump and Russia. We'll certainly keep you briefed on all aspects of that. You can also find other episodes looking at Germany's military commitment, for instance, here below if you're watching on YouTube, but also if you're listening wherever you get your podcast. And don't forget to check in with our Berlin Briefing newsletter, coming out every week, keeping you up to date, also with in-depth analysis. For this week, thanks for listening and watching, and we look forward to keeping you fully briefed up on the latest developments.